On this week's anthology...
The couple stood still on the edge of the flower bed and together pressed the end of her parasol deep down into the soft earth.
Virginia Woolf is our guide to London's Kew Gardens. Leonora Carrington paints a surrealist fable in a disquieting garden. And we travel to the enchanting Gardens of Mogador with Alberto Ruiz Sanchez.
In an ancient corner of Mogador, city of countless immigrations, between the east gate and the sea, there is a garden of crickets whose blind gardener keeps them singing all day long.
Discover.
Imagine.
Relate.
Engage.
Escape.
This is Heather Perry. Join the Cricket's Bone Caravan audio troupe for a journey of literary discovery. The conclusion of Askew Gardens, an anthology of poetry and fiction on gardens as sites of memory, transformation, and magic. This week's anthology tour of Askew Gardens starts now.
Through the window screen, I can see an angle of gray roof and the silence that spreads in the branches of the pecan tree as the sun goes down. I am waiting for a lover. I am alone in a solitude that vibrates like the cicada in hot mid-morning, that awaits like the lobed sassafras leaf just before its dark green turns into red. That awaits like the honeybee in the mouth of the purple lobelia. While I wait, I can hear the random clink of one fork against a plate. The woman next door is eating supper, alone. She is 60, perhaps, and for many years has eaten by herself the tomatoes, the corn, and okra that she grows in her backyard garden. Her small metallic sound persists, as quiet almost as the windless silence, persists like the steady random click of a red bird cracking a few more seeds before the sun gets too low. She does not hurry. She does not linger. Her younger neighbors think that she is lonely, but I know what sufficiency she may possess. I know what can be gathered from year to year, gathered from what is near to hand, as I do, elderberries that bend in damp thickets by the road, gathered and preserved, jars and jars shining in rows of claret red, made at times with help, a friend or a lover, but consumed long after they are gone and I sit alone at the kitchen table. And when I sit in the last heat of Sunday, afternoons on the porch steps in the acid breath of the boxwoods, I also know desolation. The week is over, the coming night will not lift. I am exhausted from making each day. My family, my children live in other states. The women I love in other towns. I would rather be here than with them in the old ways, but when all that's left of the sunset is the red reflection underneath the clouds, when I get up and come in to fix supper in the darkened kitchen, I am often lonely for them. In the morning and the evening, we are by ourselves, the woman next door and I. Still, we persist. I open the door to get out the silverware. She goes to her garden to pull weeds and pick the crook-neck squash that turn yellow with late summer. I walk down to the pond in the morning to watch and wait for the blue heron who comes at first light to feed on minnows that swim through her shadow in the water. She stays until the day grows so bright that she cannot endure it and leaves with her hunger unsatisfied. She bows her wings and slowly lifts into flight. Gray and slate blue against a paler sky. I know she will come back. I see the light create a russet curve of land on the farther bank, where the wild rice bends heavy and ripe until the first blackbirds. I know she will come back. I see the light curve in the fall and rise of her wing.
That was Patsy Ron reading The Sound of One Fork by Minnie Bruce Pratt from The Dirt She Ate, New and Selected Poems, published in 2003 by University of Pittsburgh Press. Pratt, who was born in Selma and grew up in Alabama, is active in lesbian and feminist causes. Her writing often explores family and its definitions for people who are LGBTQ. In the 1970s, she lost custody of her two young sons from her first marriage when she came out as lesbian. Pratt's longtime spouse, Leslie Feinberg, who died in 2014, resisted boundaries by identifying as an anti-racist, white, working-class, secular Jewish, transgender, lesbian, female revolutionary communist. You're traveling with a Cricket's Bone Caravan.
Remember how the crickets came out of their mother grass like little kin?
The title of this two-part anthology is a play on one of Virginia Woolf's best-known short stories, Kew Gardens. Though Woolf's short fiction isn't nearly as familiar as her monumental achievements in the modernist novel. In its first edition of 1919, Kew Gardens appeared in a slim volume from Hogarth, the press founded by Woolf and her husband. The text was accompanied by woodcuts from Woolf's sister, the artist Vanessa Bell. It's a visually lavish story that doesn't so much have a plot as a cumulative effect. The story is set in the National Botanical Gardens at Kew on a July day just after the First World War. The 19th century development of urban parks and gardens such as Kew, or Central Park in New York City, expressed a longing for nature as cities became oppressively industrialized. Public green spaces represented health, prosperity, and ideals of democratic access. Royal Gardens had been tended at Kew, a suburb of London, since the early 18th century, at first rather haphazardly. But beginning in 1840, the Royal Horticultural Society institutionalized the gardens as a showcase for the worldwide collection of plants that was a project of the British Empire. The significance of Kew Gardens as a monument of economic and scientific imperialism has been studied by the historian Richard Drayton. Drayton was born in Guyana, a British plantation colony from the late 18th century until independence in 1966. Kew and satellite gardens throughout the empire were, in Drayton's words, theaters in which exotic nature was literally put in its place in a European system. In Catherine Mansfield's story, The Garden Party, heard in our previous episode, the karaka trees native to New Zealand are domesticated within a colonial English garden, reduced to a backdrop for serving tea sandwiches and fancy pastries. Kew is known for its follies. Extravagant garden ornaments of architectural proportions, including a faux mosque at one time and an extant pagoda. In her story, Virginia Woolf likewise envisions Kew Gardens as a set, like an impressionist painting in its quick richness of color, but also cinematic in the swift cutting among perspectives. From close-ups of botanical detail observed at snail's eye level, dissolving at the end upward into horizon and an aerial view of the park. Conversations overheard and ghostly voices, the drone of a plane, like a phantom from the just-ended war, all capture a moment of British imperial culture poised for decline. Joan Hawkins reads Kew Gardens by Virginia Woolf.
From the oval-shaped flower bed there rose perhaps 100 stalks, spreading into heart-shaped or tongue-shaped leaves halfway up and unfurling at the tip, red or blue or yellow petals, marked with spots of color, raised upon the surface. And from the red, blue, or yellow gloom of the throat emerged a straight bar, rough with gold dust and slightly clubbed at the end. The petals were voluminous enough to be stirred by the summer breeze, and when they moved, the red, blue, and yellow lights passed one over the other, staining an inch of the brown earth beneath with a spot of the most intricate color. The light fell either upon the smooth gray back of a pebble or the shell of a snail with its brown circular veins. Or, falling into a raindrop, it expanded with such intensity of red, blue, and yellow the thin walls of water that one expected them to burst and disappear. Instead, the drop was left in a second silver gray once more, and the light now settled upon the flesh of a leaf, revealing the branching thread of fiber beneath the surface. And again it moved on and spread its illumination in the vast green spaces beneath the dome of the heart-shaped and tongue-shaped leaves. Then the breeze stirred rather more briskly overhead, and the color was flashed into the air above, into the eyes of the men and women who walk in Kew Gardens in July. The figures of these men and women straggled past the flower bed with a curiously irregular movement, not unlike that of the white and blue butterflies who crossed the turf in zigzag flights from bed to bed. The man was about 6 inches in front of the woman, strolling carelessly, while she bore on with greater purpose, only turning her head now and then to see that the children were not too far behind. The man kept this distance in front of the woman purposely, though perhaps unconsciously, for he wished to go on with his thoughts. 15 years ago I came here with Lily, he thought. We sat somewhere over there by a lake, and I begged her to marry me all through the hot afternoon. How the dragonfly kept circling round us. How clearly I see the dragonfly, and her shoe with the square silver buckle at the toe. All the time I spoke, I saw her shoe, and when it moved impatiently, I knew without looking up what she was going to say. The whole of her seemed to be in her shoe. And my love, my desire, were in the dragonfly. For some reason, I thought that if it settled there, on that leaf, the broad one with the red flower in the middle of it, if the dragonfly settled on the leaf, she would say, yes, at once. But the dragonfly went round and round. It never settled anywhere. Of course not. Happily not. Or I shouldn't be walking here with Eleanor and the children. Tell me, Eleanor, do you ever think of the past? Why do you ask, Simon? Because I've been thinking of the past. I've been thinking of Lily, the woman I might have married. Well, why are you silent? Do you mind my thinking of the past? Why should I mind, Simon? Doesn't one always think of the past in a garden with men and women lying under the trees? Aren't they one's past, all that remains of it? Those men and women, those ghosts lying under the trees? One's happiness, one's reality? For me, a square silver shoe buckle and a dragonfly. For me, a kiss. Imagine 6 little girls sitting before their easels 20 years ago down by the side of a lake, painting the water lilies, the first red water lilies I'd ever seen. And suddenly, a kiss, there on the back of my neck. And my hand shook all the afternoon so that I couldn't paint. I took out my watch and marked the hour when I would allow myself to think of the kiss for 5 minutes only. It was so precious. The kiss of an old gray-haired woman with a wart on her nose, the mother of all my kisses all my life. Come, Carolyn, come, Hubert. They walked on past the flower bed, now walking 4 abreast and soon diminished in size among the trees, and looked half-transparent as the sunlight and shade swam over their backs in large, trembling, irregular patches.
Kew
Steel Gardens by Virginia Woolf continues on Anthology.
In the oval flower bed, the snail, whose shell had been stained red, blue, and yellow for the space of 2 minutes or so, now appeared to be moving very slightly in its shell, and next began to labor over the crumbs of loose earth which broke away and rolled down as it passed over them. It appeared to have a definite goal in front of it, differing in this respect from the singular high-stepping angular green insect who attempted to cross in front of it, and waited for a second with its antennae trembling as if in deliberation, and then stepped off as rapidly and strangely in the opposite direction. Brown cliffs with deep green lakes in the hollows, flat, blade-like trees that waved from root to tip, round boulders of gray stone, vast crumpled surfaces of a thin crackling texture. All these objects lay across the snail's progress between one stalk and another to his goal. Before he had decided whether to circumvent the arched tent of a dead leaf or to breast it, there came past the bed the feet of other human beings. This time they were both men. The younger of the two wore an expression of perhaps unnatural calm. He raised his eyes and fixed them very steadily in front of him, while his companion spoke, and directly his companion had done speaking, he looked on the ground again, and sometimes opened his lips only after a long pause, and sometimes did not open them at all. The elder man had a curiously uneven and shaky method of walking, jerking his hand forward and throwing up his head abruptly, rather in the manner of an impatient carriage horse tired of waiting outside a house. But in the man, these gestures were irresolute and pointless. He talked almost incessantly. He smiled to himself and again began to talk, as if the smile had been an answer. He was talking about spirits, the spirits of the dead, who, according to him, were even now telling him all sorts of odd things about their experiences in heaven. Heaven was known to the ancients as Thessaly, William, and now, with this war, the spirit matter is rolling between the hills like thunder. He paused, seemed to listen, smiled, jerked his head, and continued. You have a small electric battery and a piece of rubber to insulate the wire. Isolate? Insulate? Well, we'll skip the details. No good going into details that wouldn't be understood. And in short, the little machine stands in any convenient position by the head of the bed. We will say on a neat mahogany stand. All the arrangements being properly fixed by workmen under my direction, the widow applies her ear and summons the spirit by sign as agreed. Women, widows, women in black. Here he seemed to have caught sight of a woman's dress in the distance, which in the shade looked a purple-black. He took off his hat, placed his hand upon his heart, and hurried towards her, muttering and gesticulating feverishly. But William caught him by the sleeve and touched a flower with the tip of his walking stick in order to divert the old man's attention. After looking at it for a moment in some confusion, the old man bent his ear to it and seemed to answer a voice speaking from it, for he began talking about the forests of Uruguay, which he had visited hundreds of years ago in company with the most beautiful young woman in Europe. He could be heard murmuring about forests of Uruguay, blanketed with the wax petals of tropical roses, nightingales, sea beaches, mermaids, and women drowned at sea, as he suffered himself to be moved on by William, upon whose face the look of stoical patience grew slowly deeper and deeper. Following his steps so closely as to be slightly puzzled by his gestures, came two elderly women of the lower middle class, one stout and ponderous, the other rosy-cheeked and nimble. Like most people of their station, they were frankly fascinated by any signs of eccentricity betokening a disordered brain, especially in the well-to-do. But they were too far off to be certain whether the gestures were merely eccentric or genuinely mad. After they had scrutinized the old man's back in silence for a moment and given each other a queer, sly look, they went on energetically piecing together their very complicated dialogue. Nell, Bert, Lot, Sess, Phil, Pa, he says, I says, she says, I says, I says, I says. My bird, Sis, Bill, Granddad, the old man, Sugar. Sugar flower kippers greens. Sugar, sugar, sugar. The ponderous woman looked through the pattern of falling words at the flowers standing cool, firm, and upright in the earth with a curious expression. She saw them as a sleeper waking from a heavy sleep sees a brass candlestick reflecting the light in an unfamiliar way and closes his eyes and opens them, and seeing the brass candlestick again finally starts broad awake and stares at the candlestick with all his powers. So the heavy woman came to a standstill opposite the oval-shaped flower bed and ceased even to pretend to listen to what the other woman was saying. She stood there letting the words fall over her, swaying the top part of her body slowly backwards and forwards, looking at the flowers. Then she suggested that they should find a seat and have their tea. The snail had now considered every possible method of reaching his goal without going round the dead leaf or climbing over it, let alone the effort needed for climbing a leaf. He was doubtful whether the thin texture, which vibrated with such an alarming crackle when touched even by the tip of his horns, would bear his weight, and this determined him finally to creep beneath it, for there was a point where the leaf curved high enough from the ground to admit him. He had just inserted his head in the opening and was taking stock of the high brown roof and was getting used to the cool brown light when two other people came past outside on the turf. This time they were both young, a young man and a young woman. They were both in the prime of youth, or even in that season which precedes the prime of youth, the season before the smooth pink folds of the flower have burst their gummy case, when the wings of the butterfly, though fully grown, are motionless in the sun. "Lucky it isn't Friday," he observed. "Why? Do you believe in luck?" "They make you pay sixpence on Friday." "What's sixpence anyway? Isn't it worth sixpence?" "What's it? What do you mean by it?" "Oh, anything. I mean, you know what I mean." Long pauses came between each of these remarks. They were uttered in toneless and monotonous voices. The couple stood still on the edge of the flower bed and together pressed the end of her parasol deep down into the soft earth. The action and the fact that his hand rested on the top of hers expressed their feelings in a strange way, as these short, insignificant words also expressed something, words with short wings for their heavy body of meaning, inadequate to carry them far, and thus alighting awkwardly upon the very common objects that surrounded them, and were to their inexperienced touch so massive. But who knows? So they thought as they pressed the parasol into the earth. What precipices aren't concealed in them? Or what slopes of ice don't shine in the sun on the other side? Who knows? Who has ever seen this before? Even when she wondered what sort of tea they gave you at Kew, he felt that something loomed up behind her words and stood vast and solid behind them, and the mist very slowly rose and uncovered. Oh, heavens, what were those shapes? The little white tables and waitresses who looked first at her and then at him, and there was a bill that he would pay with a real 2-shilling piece. And it was real, all real, he assured himself, fingering the coin in his pocket. Real to everyone except to him and to her. Even to him it began to seem real. And then, but it was too exciting to stand and think any longer, and he pulled the parasol out of the earth with a jerk and was impatient to find the place where one had tea with other people, like other people. "Come along, Trissy, it's time we had our tea." "Wherever does one have one's tea?" she asked with the oddest thrill of excitement in her voice, looking vaguely round and letting herself be drawn on down the grass path, trailing her parasol turning her head this way and that way, forgetting her tea, wishing to go down there and then down there, remembering orchids and cranes among wild flowers, a Chinese pagoda, and a crimson-crested bird, but he bore her on. Thus, one couple after another, with much the same irregular and aimless movement, passed the flower bed and were enveloped in layer after layer of green-blue vapor, in which at first their bodies had substance and a dash of color, but later both substance and color dissolved in the green-blue atmosphere. How hot it was! So hot that even the thrush chose to hop like a mechanical bird in the shadow of the flowers, with long pauses between one movement and the next. Instead of rambling vaguely, the white butterflies danced one above another, making with their white shifting flakes the outline of a shattered marble column above the tallest flowers. The glass roofs of the palm house shone as if a whole market full of shiny green umbrellas had opened in the sun. And in the drone of the aeroplane, the voice of the summer sky murmured its fierce soul. Yellow and black, pink and snow white, shapes of all these colors. Men, women, and children were spotted for a second upon the horizon, and then seeing the breadth of yellow that lay upon the grass, they wavered and sought shade beneath the trees, dissolving like drops of water in the yellow and green atmosphere, staining it faintly with red and blue. It seemed as if all gross and heavy bodies had sunk down in the heat, motionless, and lay huddled upon the ground. But their voices went wavering from them, as if they were flames lolling from the thick waxen bodies of candles. Voices, yes, voices, wordless voices, breaking the silence suddenly with such depth of contentment, such passion of desire, or in the voices of children, such freshness of surprise. Breaking the silence? But there was no silence. All the time the motor omnibuses were tuning their wheels and changing their gear, like a vast nest of Chinese boxes, all of wrought steel, turning ceaselessly, one within another, the city murmured. And the petals of myriads of flowers flashed their colors into the air.
In a letter to Virginia Woolf after reading a draft of Kew Gardens, Catherine Mansfield wrote, "There's a still, quivering, changing light over it all and a sense of those couples dissolving in the bright air, which fascinates me. I have a queer feeling about the conversations. I don't feel that I understood in the least what is being said, any more than the snail did, or the flowers. They are, as you say, just voices." The Seventh Horse by Leonora Carrington is a surrealist fable, a fairy tale set in an entangling garden that submerges adult themes of infidelity, domestic abuse, and dark secrets. With its talking bird and strange creature of a protagonist, the story might lend itself to a short film by Tim Burton. The shrill, cartoonish characters test our capacity to take their psychic wounds seriously. Carrington was also an artist, whose paintings and sculptures hold more appeal for some admirers than her fiction. Her first surrealist painting was The Inn of the Dawn Horse, self-portrait. The subject is seated in a blue side chair, in a mostly empty room of blue-gray walls and a terracotta tile floor. Before her, a graceful she hyena, yes, graceful, lifts one paw, about to prance, or perhaps take the artist's hand, both of them challenging the viewer with a direct gaze, the hyena with humanly blue eyes. On the wall, over the untamed brown mane of the self-depicted artist, is mounted a white, as if unpainted, rocking horse. And through decorous yellow curtains around a window that frames a decorous vista of evergreens, a white horse escapes. A mare, one supposes, though nothing indicates the sex of the horse except a graphic kinship between its hind legs and Leonora's own white jodhpurse. Horses are a recurring motif of her work. The equine central character of The Seventh Horse, like that of many other of her stories, is also an androgyne. Hevelino has a masculine name, but is referred to as she, and like female victims of rape in classical mythology, is caught in an intermediary state that is at once human, animal, and vegetative. The story's ending evokes, but reverses, the myth in which Europa is carried away by Zeus in the form of a bull. The name of the only human male in the story is also classicizing. Philip means a lover of horses in Greek. Leonora Carrington was born to a wealthy family in the north of England in 1917. The folk tales of her Irish nanny were an early influence on her storytelling. Reared as a Roman Catholic, she was expelled from convent school and instead got to study at an art academy in Florence. By the late 1930s, she was living in Paris, where she met the surrealist artist Max Ernst. He was 25 years older and left his second wife for Carrington. The two lived in Provence until he was interned as an undesirable foreigner during the occupation. Carrington suffered a breakdown. To try and save their house from the Germans, she signed it over to a Frenchman who took advantage of the situation by seizing their property. After his release from the camp, Ernst appealed to the wealthy arts patron Peggy Guggenheim for help in getting back his valuable sculpture collection. Carrington had disappeared. Although the two met again, Ernst left Europe with Guggenheim, whom he later married. Carrington escaped to Spain, but when she sought refuge at the British Embassy in Madrid, she was diagnosed as psychotic, confined to an asylum, and subjected to an intense regimen of psychotherapeutic drugs and electroshock therapy. After her release, she connected with a Mexican diplomat, a writer who was a friend of Picasso. She married him, and they fled Europe in 1941. Around the time she wrote The Seventh Horse. It's tempting to see the overstuffed bird in the story as Ernst's alter ego, the bird Lop Lop, featured in so many of his paintings. Although her marriage was brief, Carrington made Mexico her permanent home and spent her long and artistically productive life there. She was creating large-scale bronze sculptures in her 90s, forms described as recognizably human but fantastical, both comic and horrific. Leonora Carrington died in 2011, eulogized as the last surviving artist of a generation that included André Breton, Man Ray, and Miro. The centenary of her birth will be marked April 2017 with the publication of a volume of her complete stories, including the story you'll hear today, from the literary publisher Dorothy. New York Review Books will republish a volume of Carrington's early work and a previously unpublished and notably unorthodox children's book, The Milk of Dreams. The Cricket's Bone Caravan continues its tour of Askew Gardens, and now Renee Reed reads The Seventh Horse by Leonora Carrington.
A strange-looking creature was hopping about in the midst of a bramble bush. She was caught by her long hair, which was so closely entwined in the brambles that she could move neither backwards nor forwards. She was cursing and hopping till the blood flowed down her body.
"I do not like the look of it,"
said one of the two ladies who intended to visit the rose garden.
"It might be a young woman, and yet..."
"This is my garden,"
replied the other, who was as thin and dry as a stick.
"And I strongly object to trespasses. I expect it is my poor, silly little husband who has let her in. He is such a child, you know."
"I've been here for years," shrieked the creature angrily. "But you are too stupid to have seen me."
"Impertinent as well,"
remarked the first lady, who was called Miss Myrtle.
"I think you had better call the gardener, Mildred. I don't think it is quite safe to go so near. The creature seems to have no modesty."
Hevelino tugged angrily at her hair, as if she would like to get at Mildred and her companion. The two ladies turned to go, not before they had exchanged a long look of hate with Hevelino. The spring evening was lengthening before the gardener came to set Hevelino free.
John,
said Hevelino, lying down on the grass,
can you count up to 7? Do you know that I can hate for 77 million years without stopping for rest? Tell those miserable people that they are doomed.
She trailed off towards the stable where she lived, muttering as she went, 77, 77. There were certain parts of the garden where all the flowers, trees, and plants grew tangled together. Even on the hottest days, these places were in blue shadow. There were deserted figures overgrown with moss, still fountains, and old toys, decapitated and destitute. Nobody went there except Hevelino. She would kneel and eat the short grass and watch a fascinating fat bird who never moved away from his shadow. He let his shadow glide around him as the day went by and over him when there was a moon. He always sat with his hairy mouth wide open, and moths and little insects would fly in and out. Hevelino went to see the bird dining the night after she was caught in the brambles. A retinue of 6 horses accompanied her. They walked 7 times around the fat bird in silence.
Who's there?
Said the bird eventually, in a whistling voice.
It is I, Hevelino, with my 6 horses.
You are keeping me awake with your stumping and snorting, came the plaintive reply.
If I cannot sleep, I can see neither the past nor the future. I shall waste away if you won't go away and let me sleep.
They are going to come and kill you, said Hevelino. You had better keep awake. I heard somebody say you would be roasted in hot fat, stuffed with parsley and onions, and then eaten.
The corpulent bird cast an apprehensive eye on Hevelino, who was watching him closely.
How do you know?
Breathed the bird.
Just tell me that.
You are much too fat to fly,
continued Hevelino relentlessly.
If you tried to fly, you'd be like a fat toad doing his death dance.
How do you know this?
Screamed the bird.
They can't know where I am. I've been here for 77 years.
They don't know you yet. Not yet.
Hevelino had her face close to his open beak. Her lips were drawn back, and the bird could see her long wolf's teeth. His fat little body quivered like a jelly.
What do you want of me?
Hevelino gave a sort of crooked smile.
Ah, that's better.
She and the 6 horses made a circle around the bird and watched him with their prominent and restless eyes.
I want to know exactly what is going on in the house, said she, and be quick about it.
The bird cast a frightened look around him, but the horses had sat down. There was no escape. He became wet with sweat, and the feathers clung, draggled to his fat stomach.
I cannot say,
he said at last in a strangled voice.
Something terrible will befall us if I say what I can see.
Roasted in hot fat and eaten, said Hevelino.
You are mad to want to know things that do not concern you.
I am waiting, said Hevelino.
The bird gave a long, convulsive shudder and turned his eyes, which had become bulging and sightless, to the east.
They are at dinner,
he said eventually, and a great black moth flew out of his mouth.
The table is laid for 3 people. Mildred and her husband have begun to eat their soup. She's watching him suspiciously. I found something unpleasant in the garden today, she says, laying down her spoon. I doubt if she will eat any more now.
What was that?
Asked he.
Why do you look so angry?
Miss Myrtle has come into the room now. She looks from one to the other. She seems to guess what they are discussing, for she says,
Yes, really, Philip, I think you ought to be more careful whom you let into the garden.
What are you talking about?
He says angrily.
How do you expect me to stop anything if I don't know what I am stopping?
It was an unpleasant-looking creature, half-naked and caught in a bramble bush. I had to turn my eyes away.
You let this creature free, of course.
Indeed I did not. I consider it just as well that she was trapped as she was. By the cruel look on her face, I should judge she would have done us serious harm.
What? You left this poor creature trapped in the brambles? Mildred, there are times when you revolt me. I am sick of you pottering around the village and annoying the poor with your religious preamble. And now, when you see a poor thing in your own garden, you do nothing but shudder with false modesty.
Mildred gives a shocked cry and covers her face with a slightly soiled handkerchief.
Philip, why do you say such cruel things to me, your wife?
Philip, with an expression of resigned annoyance, asks,
Try and describe this creature. Is it an animal or a woman?
I can say no more,
sobs the wife.
After what you have said to me, I feel faint.
You should be more careful,
whispers Miss Myrtle.
In her delicate condition.
What do you mean, delicate condition?
Asks Philip irritably.
I do wish people would say what they mean.
Why, you surely must know.
Miss Myrtle simpers.
You're going to become a daddy in a short time.
Philip goes white with rage.
I won't stand for these fatuous lies. It is quite impossible that Mildred is pregnant. She has not graced my bed for 5 whole years, and unless the Holy Ghost is in the house, I don't see how it came about. For Mildred is unpleasantly virtuous, and I cannot imagine her abandoning herself to anybody.
Mildred, is this true?
Says Miss Myrtle, trembling with delicious expectation. Mildred shrieks and sobs.
He's a liar! I'm going to have a darling little baby in 3 months!
Philip flings down his spoon and serviette and gets to his feet.
For the 7th time in 7 days, I shall finish my dinner upstairs,
says he, and stops for an instant, as if his words have awakened some memory. He puts it away from him and shakes his head.
All I ask is that you don't come whining after me,
he says to his wife and quits the room. She shrieks,
Philip, my darling little husband, come back and eat your soup. I promise I won't be naughty anymore.
Too late,
comes the voice of Philip from the staircase.
Too late now.
He goes slowly up to the top of the house with his eyes looking a long way ahead of him. His face is strained, as if in the effort of listening to faraway voices chattering between nightmares and dead reality. He reaches the attic at the top of the house, where he seats himself on an old trunk. I believe that the trunk is filled with ancient laces, frilly knickers, and dresses, but they are old and torn. There is a black moth making his dinner on them as Philip sits staring at the window. He considers a stuffed hedge pig on the mantelpiece, who looks worn out with suffering. Philip seems to be smothered with the atmosphere of this attic. He flings open the window and gives a long...
Here, the bird paused, and a long, sickening neigh rent the night. The 6 horses leapt to their feet and replied in their piercing voices. Javelino stood stock still with her lips drawn back and her nostrils quivering.
Philip, the friend of the horses.
The 6 horses thundered off toward the stable, as if obeying an age-old summons. Javelino, with a shuddering sigh, followed, her hair streaming behind her. Philip was at the stable door as they arrived. His face was luminous and as white as snow. He counted 7 horses as they galloped by. He caught the 7th by the mane and leapt onto her back. The mare galloped as if her heart would burst, and all the time Philip was in a great ecstasy of love. He felt as if he had grown onto the back of this beautiful black mare and that they were one creature. At the crack of dawn, all of the horses were back in their places, and the little wrinkled groom was rubbing off the cake sweat and mud of the night. His creased face smiled wisely as he rubbed his charges with infinite care. He appeared not to notice the master, who stood alone in an empty stall. But he knew he was there.
How many horses have I?
Said Philip at last.
6, sir,
said the little groom without ceasing to smile. That night, the corpse of Mildred was found near the stable. One would believe that she had been trampled to death, and yet... They are all as gentle as lambs, said the little groom.
If Mildred had been pregnant, there was no sign of it as she was stuffed into a respectable black coffin. However, nobody could explain the presence of a small, misshapen foal that had found its way into the seventh empty stall.
In her work, Carrington draws on magic, alchemy, the Kabbalah, and other occult traditions to dislodge subjective experience from pretenses of rationalism. The mystical number 7 is predominant in the story you just heard. She and other women surrealists aimed to expose or subvert the tendencies of their male counterparts who visually dismembered and blurred the boundaries of the female body. The reference to Philip as a man-child echo Peggy Guggenheim's sentiment that Max Ernst was something like a child abandoned on her doorstep. We close today with The Garden of Voices by Alberto Ruiz Sanchez. The selection comes from the third volume of his series, The Secret Gardens of Mogador, published in English translation by White Pine Press in 2009. Ruiz Sanchez was born in Mexico City in 1951. His many books of fiction, essays, and poetry have been translated into at least 8 languages. The Secret Gardens of Mogador, subtitled Voices of the Earth, is part of a tetralogy in which each volume represents one of the 4 classical elements of air, water, earth, and fire. Alchemy, geometry, architecture, music, dance, painting, film, the history of the arts and sciences is the armature on which Ruiz Sanchez crafts his writings. Rhonda Buchanan, who translated Voices of the Earth, describes him as an international writer, a world traveler, and a true global citizen. In 1975, when he was in his mid-20s, he made his first trip to Morocco. There, the sight of the Sahara bursting into bloom after more than a decade of drought powerfully evoked a childhood memory of overnight rain yielding a yellow carpet of flowers after 10 dry years in his own Sonoran desert. Discovering cultural affinities between Mexico and the Middle East, collapsing distances of time and geography, became a driving inspiration for his work. These affinities are historical. The presence and at times dominance of Arabic culture on the Iberian Peninsula for nearly 8 centuries left deep cultural and linguistic connections that were transferred to Mexico. Mogador is the ancient name of a real place, the city Essaouira on the Atlantic coast of Morocco, but that may or may not matter. For the book's narrator, the city is a storehouse of the imagination, a collection of stories each contained in one of its secret gardens. In a gender reversal of the Scheherazade tale, he makes a daily journey to retrieve a story enchanting enough to gratify a demanding, elusive lover. Erotic desire permeates the book. Ruiz Sanchez has stated, "Nothing is known and nothing occurs that is not first inscribed on the body." And for Buchanan, translation is itself an erotic act charged with desire for intimacy. Frank Buzelich reads The Garden of Voices from The Secret Gardens of Mogador by Alberto Ruiz Sanchez, who lends us his voice in the original Spanish. As a side note, this story was one of the inspirations for the name of our audio troupe.
En un antiguo rincón de Mogador, ciudad de inmigraciones incontables, de sangres y lenguas y sueños que se cruzan en un arabesco infinito,
in an ancient corner of Mogador, city of countless immigrations, of blood and tongues and dreams that intersect in an infinite arabesque, there once was a small but very vibrant Chinatown whose interior gardens were not created with plants, but stones. According to legend, those strange rocks had been brought by sea from distant countries where silk was sold. Besides their beauty, they had the natural gift of covering themselves with a spongy red moss that spread quickly. That is why in the city they would say that the humidity there made the stones grow until they touched the sky, and that only the clouds could soothe them. In that same legendary corner of Mogador, very near the walls. Between the east gate and the sea, there is a garden of crickets, whose blind gardener keeps them singing all day long. If you visit it in the morning, you will see the gardener vigorously shredding all the plants he finds, including the most beautiful and rare. That always upsets those who see him for the first time, unaware that in this garden there are no leaves or flowers except those torn and placed in the small cages by that man as food for his crickets. The gardener knows which plants each tiny creature loves to eat, and which can lower or raise their pitch. He classifies and names the flowers for their digestive values, that is, for the range of sounds that they may help to emit once digested, as if the only or principal reason for being of each flower was to transform itself into a beautiful cricket song. The flower is to the song what the caterpillar is to the butterfly. Astonishing metamorphosis, he would tell his visitors. We are also intrigued by the boxes made of wood, ivory, or bone where he keeps his crickets. Some are quite simple, but no less beautiful, with straw bars and sliding doors over small wooden tongues. They hang from the trees like fruits that sing when someone draws near. Others are tiny statues. The gardener himself has adorned them with rare woods and inscribed in calligraphy the names he gives each cricket, a name originating from the range of sounds it produces. He also carves a sign that describes its place in the Garden of Voices. Before him, his father did this, and his grandfather, and the father of his grandfather. 100 years ago, there were 20 decorative cages tended by his great-grandfather, like an exquisite orchard. His son multiplied the orchard by 5 and the grandson by 10. Thus, this gardener inherited 1,000 cages and a small fortune to maintain them, plus the family tradition refined by 3 generations before him, not counting the centuries this art was cultivated in China. Over 25 years, this man has made the garden grow, and now there are nearly 3,000 cages that form labyrinthine paths, a web similar to that created by the streets of the city. Those who cannot orient themselves by their sounds run the risk of losing themselves forever in this garden. Shouts for help would be useless, just one more among many. There are many things besides food that may alter the chanting of the crickets, and one of them is invisible and powerful. It is desire. The gardener knows that placing some cages next to others will lead to enthusiastic chirps of courtship throughout the night. And he knows that if he separates them, little by little, a deep, sorrowful tone dominates that song. Distance is an imaginary chord of desires that he fine-tunes continuously. The love song of these creatures is so poignant and resolute that for a long time the poets of Mogador and its surroundings have compared it to the intuitive passion one body has for another. Ibn Hazm says that when two lovers look at each other from a distance, all the crickets of their bodies tingle hungrily. Aziz Aghazali writes that in Mogador the crickets search for the warmth of fire, which is why they stay in kitchens, near the community bread ovens, or by the cauldrons of the public steam baths, the hammam, where often they are displayed as an emblem carved in the entrance. The story is also told that in the house of a woman named Fatma, who saw her senses flower suddenly in the surprising light of desire, the crickets had nestled beneath her bed and sang like springtime in summer, even on the rawest days of winter. Everyone in Mogador seems to agree that crickets sing differently during each season of the year and are even capable of announcing their arrival. Well-trained, they can measure the temperature of the day precisely. This gardener always goes to extremes and has raised a type of cricket that can measure the temperature of the body. It is particularly small, and its voice is faint and low, but vibrates forcefully. They call this species the smile of the moon. According to observations, it begins singing when the desire between two people increases, and naturally their body heat as well. Some carry the crickets on their romantic encounters, hidden in their clothes, very close to the skin, to feel the vibration of their song rather than hear it. That is why Ibn Hazm, in a book that follows his poetic manual of love, The Necklace of the Dove, includes a chapter in which he instructs us to search with patience and sustained expectations between the thousand folds of the beloved's garments for those denouncing crickets. Then he advises the lover to continue searching the folds of his mistress's naked body, as if to find in them a thousand smiles of the moon. In this garden of Mogador, before the sun rises, when a light blanket of dew falls over the cages, depositing in them several heavy drops, the crickets can be heard drinking. Their whistling moistens, their happiness gurgles. If they drink too much before the sun rises, they emit a strange, involuntary vibration as if they were quivering from cold. Some afternoons, when the wind is still, the blind gardener tries to enter the clouds of mosquitoes that gather on the southern beach at sunset. He lets them bite him until, inflated with blood, they can no longer fly, and he captures them easily to offer as a delicacy to some of his crickets, particularly those dark, obese ones that, while eating, sing their joy with deep notes like heavy bells. The gardener recognizes each one by its sounds. He knows that science has developed several efficient methods for classifying them, but he only cares to distinguish them by their voices, which he does with remarkable precision. He has come to identify with certainty 2,633 different types of sounds. He had to subtract 4 from his list this year when he realized that the crickets did not make them, but he himself, or rather his body, upon walking hastily, breathing heavily on hot days, sighing with joy while listening to his creatures, digesting with difficulty those leaves and flowers that his animals left untouched and he did not wish to waste. When night falls, the scribe approaches the garden cautiously to offer his services should the gardener wish to record new sounds. His list grows and each description becomes more precise. So, for example, next to echoes of drops over fire, sound 1,327, reads the description, like saliva between teeth, like a sudden longing to drink. This repeats itself in intervals of 10 drops, each alike. But the gardener is never satisfied with his transcription in words, and so he has invented a type of score with small river stones of different shapes that he places on a long table. Although some would consider this display of pebbles worthless, he is convinced that the annotation, which only he understands, is also a tactile map of the sounds of his garden. At night, he catches himself humming it out loud. On more than one occasion, his own chanting of the map has led him to shift the cages and thus modify the composition of his unusual pebble bed. Moved by the intensity of certain voices in his garden, and brimming with pride for achieving them, some of the sounds discovered by him appear on the list with his own name. They are his creatures. And the stories he likes to tell about each cage, about how he trapped or was able to incubate each insect, about the life and habits of his little beasts, could excite whoever had the good fortune to hear them, as if the Canterbury Tales or those of the Decameron or the Arabian Nights were inspired by this garden of crickets. He has learned to control many of those hundreds of insect sounds. He can make them reproduce. In a way, he is capable of sowing them. He experiences his greatest happiness when he hears them blossom, mature. At times, even when others see and what he only touches becomes a sound for this blind man, if it is truly amazing. That happens in different ways, but especially with a creature that came to Mogador by boat from a walled city of Guinea. It is a strange type of beautiful grasshopper that reigns over his garden pretentiously. Its wings, more beautiful and shimmering than a morpho butterfly, are twice the size of its body. They are green, yellow, and purple, and the chirping of this cricket unfolds that spectrum in a way that only the gardener hears. For him, blind from birth like his father and grandfather, space does not exist if it does not produce sounds. The very idea of a silent garden is something he cannot imagine. Voices sprout around him. They flower, grow orchards, create an enveloping enclosure. Sensations of distance and intimacy, of depth and resounding perspective, of beauty from afar, and naturally of desire. Perhaps that is why some say that this gardener is not blind, but merely closes his eyes most of the day in order to reproduce the feeling of walking among voices, sown, blossoming, and gathered. I always recall that garden whenever you touch me with closed eyes, and your breathing changes with mine. When at night my name intertwines indecipherably with yours, when we no longer know what we tell each other, and tenderness flows in long vowels, sighs, moans, and hoarse whispers. When I explore in you, even in the folds of your dreams, the most ephemeral smiles of the moon. When I think of you and hear you as my garden of voices.
Pienso siempre en ese jardín cuando me tocas con los ojos cerrados y tu respiración se altera en la mía. Cuando mi nombre se anuda indescifrable al tuyo en la noche. Cuando ya no sabemos lo que nos decimos y la ternura se nos llena de vocales largas, de quejas, de gemidos, de rasguños con la voz. Cuando busco en ti y hasta en los pliegues de tus sueños las más breves sonrisas de la luna. Cuando te pienso y te escucho como mi jardín de voces.
You've been listening to the conclusion of the Askew Gardens Anthology. Anthology is produced by Loose Lit Media for WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana. The voices of the Cricket's Bone Caravan in this episode were
Frank Buzzelich,
Joan Hawkins,
Patsy Ron,
Renee Reed.
Anthology is produced, written, and edited by Cynthia Wolf. Our theme music is Kong by Ciro Baptista from his album Blue Fly, released in 2016 by Zadik. To learn more about the music from this week's episode, visit indianapublicmedia.org/anthology. Can you identify this week's cricket quote?
Remember how the crickets came out of their mother grass like little kin?
Tweet us at cricketsbone if you know the source, or email us at looselit@gmail.com. And join us next time for a special anthology episode. Has anybody seen Miss Dora Dean? A short story about race and sexual identity within a black community of the 1940s by Anne Petrie. Petrie was the first African-American woman to sell 1 million copies of a novel, but remains one of the most underrated fiction writers in American literature. For Anthology, this is Heather Perry. Thanks for listening.